The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. Today we're reading from Smithsonian Magazine because we used up all the stories in the combined January-February edition of Smithsonian. Under the heading Smart News, three U.S. planes lost during World War II found in Pacific Lagoon by Teresa Mackheimer. Researchers from Project Recover, a joint endeavor of the University of Delaware and the University of California, San Diego, that aims to find and repatriate Americans missing in action since World War II, recently located the wreckage of three U.S. military aircraft lost during a February 1944 battle in the conflict's Pacific Theater. The team discovered the two SBD-5 Dauntless dive bombers and one TBM/F1 Avenger while searching Truk Lagoon in the Chuuk state of Micronesia. 76 years ago, the body of water was the site of Operation Hailstone, a two-day Allied air assault on a Japanese naval base. More than 50 Japanese ships and 230 total aircraft, 30 of which were American, were lost in the depths of the lagoon during the skirmish. An airplane gunner's account of the operation helped Project Recover spot the U.S. planes, which can be difficult to pick out among the array of coral-covered debris found at the bottom of Truk Lagoon. As Project Recover historian Colin Colburn tells Live Science's Mindy Weisberger, the gunner saw a Dauntless dive bomber fall while firing on a Japanese transport ship, which also sunk. We were able to line up this piece of the puzzle with this other piece of the puzzle. Okay, let's focus our search around this ship, says Colburn. And that was actually where we ended up finding this airplane. The research team conducted four expeditions between April 2018 and December 2019 using an autonomous robot that completed repetitive sonar scans of the ocean floor. The group surveyed about 27 square miles of the lagoon, identifying signs of unnatural debris in 61 sites. Divers and robots carrying cameras investigated the area further and found debris fields littered with the aircraft's remains at depths of between 100 and 250 feet. Truk Lagoon's numerous sunken Japanese ships, some of which still hold airplanes and trucks, made it a popular scuba diving destination, according to Live Science. But the researchers aren't surprised that the planes went unnoticed for so long. When these aircraft crash into the water, they don't look like aircraft anymore, Mark Moline, expedition leader and director of the University of Delaware's School of Marine Science and Policy, tells Dylan Grisk of Military Times. Most of them are piles of metal that don't rise very far off the bottom of the ocean. The exception is the propeller, usually sticking out. Typically, the team compares historical records of aircraft that went missing during military operations to debris recovered in a specific region. In this case, Colburn tells Military Times, records show only two Dauntless dive bombers lost in the area search. After identifying wrecks, researchers determined which service members were piloting the vessels during a given battle. Once the aircraft debris fields have been archaeologically surveyed, the project team give the data to the U.S. Defense POW/MIA Accounting Agency, which handles attempts to recover servicemen's remains. What we've seen is that the cockpit area is somewhat intact, so the potential is that the remains could be there, says Daniel O'Brien, one of Project Recover's directors, to the New York Times' John Ismay. The bodies could have been ejected or floated away, but there's a good chance the remains are still with the aircraft. Including the latest finds, Project Recovery has located 28 aircraft and ensured repatriation of 13 sets of remains to date. The researchers plan on continuing their work at Truk Lagoon, which may house the wrecks of 33 aircraft carrying almost 100 missing service members, Coburn tells Military Times. They also want to travel to Kuwait to look for a Navy A-6 intruder lost in the Persian Gulf during Operation Desert Storm in 1991. Around 79,000 American service members went missing during World War II. Today, more than 72,000 remain unaccounted for. Even though we are focused on finding aircraft, the aircraft aren't really our interest, Moline tells Military Times. We are only doing this to return and identify MIAs. That's really our core mission. The main headline is bringing our guys home. Teresa McIver is a freelance writer based in Washington, D.C. Her work has also appeared in National Geographic and Science Show. Next, Smithsonian releases 2.8 million images into public domain. The launch of a new open access platform ushers in a new era of possibility for the institution. By Catherine J. Wu. Culture connoisseurs rejoice. The Smithsonian Institution is inviting the world to engage with its vast repository of resources like never before. For the first time in its 174-year history, the Smithsonian has released 2.8 million high-resolution, two- and three-dimensional images from across its collections onto an open-access online platform for patrons to peruse and download free of charge. Featuring data and material from all 19 Smithsonian museums, 9 research centers, libraries, archives, and the National Zoo, the new digital depot encourages the public to not just view its contents, but use, reuse, and transform them into just about anything they choose, be it a postcard, a beer koozie, or a pair of booty shorts. And this gargantuan data dump is just the beginning. Throughout the rest of 2020, the Smithsonian will be rolling out another 200,000 or so images, with more to come as the institution continues to digitize its collection of 155 million items and counting. Being a relevant source for people who are learning around the world is key to our mission, says Effie Capsalis, who is heading up the effort as the Smithsonian Senior Digital Program Officer. We can't imagine what people are going to do with the collections. We're prepared to be surprised. The database's launch also marks the latest victory for a growing global effort to migrate museum collections into the public domain. Nearly 200 other institutions worldwide, including Amsterdam's Rijksmuseum, New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art, and the Art Institute of Chicago, have made several moves to digitize and liberate their masterworks in recent years. But the scale of the Smithsonian's release is unprecedented in both depth and breadth, says Simon Tanner, an expert in digital cultural heritage at King's College London. Spanning the arts and humanities to science and engineering, the release compiles artifacts, specimens, and datasets from an array of fields onto a single online platform. Noteworthy additions include portraits of Pocahontas and Ida B. Wells, images of Muhammad Ali's boxing headgear, and Amelia Earhart's record-shattering Lockheed Vega 5B. Along with thousands of 3D models that range in size from a petite Umbria orchid just a few centimeters in length to a Cassiopeia A supernova remnant, estimated to be about 29 light years across. The sheer scale of this interdisciplinary data set is astonishing, says Tanner, who advised Smithsonian's Open Access Initiative. It opens up a much wider scope of content that crosses science and culture, space and time, in a way that no other collection out there has done or could possibly even do. This is a staggering contribution to human knowledge. Until recently, the Smithsonian was among the thousands of museums and cultural centers around the world that still retain the rights of high-quality digital versions of their artworks, releasing them only upon request for personal or educational purposes, and forbidding commercialization. The reluctance is often justified. Institutions may be beholden to copyrights, for instance, or worry that ceding control over certain works could lead to their exploitation or forgery, or sully their reputation through sheer overuse. Till Capsalis thinks the benefits of the Smithsonian's public push, which falls in line with the institution's new digital-first strategy, will far outweigh the potential downsides. Bad actors will still do bad, she says. We're empowering good actors to do good. One of the most tangible perks, Tanner says, is a massive increase in the scale of the public's interaction with the Smithsonian, something that will maintain and boost the organization's already substantial cultural cachet for audiences old and new, especially as content trickles onto open knowledge platforms like Wikipedia. As soon as you open the collections up, it's transformative, he says. Most of the change, however, will happen far beyond the Smithsonian's walls. Listed under a Creative Commons Zero CCO license, the 2.8 million images in the new database are now liberated from all restrictions, copyright or otherwise, enabling anyone with a decent internet connection to build on them as raw materials and ultimately participate in their evolution. Digitizing the knowledge that's held at the Smithsonian to access and reuse transfers a lot of the power to the public, says Andrea Wallace, an expert in cultural heritage law at the University of Exeter. People are now free to interact with these images, she says, according to their own ideas, their own parameters, their own inspirations, completely unencumbered. To showcase a few of the countless spin-offs that access to the collection might generate, the Smithsonian invited artists, educators, and researchers for a sneak peek into the archives, and will be featuring some of their creations at a launch event to take place. Among them, a series of cultures crafted by artist Amy Carl, depicting the National Museum of Natural History's 66-million-year-old Triceratops. Carl, who specializes in 3D artwork that highlight body form and function, was keen on bringing the fossil to life in an era where modern technology has made de-extinctions of ancient species a tantalizing possibility. Six of her nine 3D printed sculptures are intricate casts of Hatcher's spine, each slightly remixed in the spirit of bioengineering. It's really important to share this kind of data, Carl says. Otherwise, it's like having a library with all the doors closed. Also on deck for the evening are three Smithsonian-inspired songs produced in collaboration with the Portland-based nonprofit N.M. Boedeker Foundation, which offers creative mentorship to local students. Written and recorded by Boedeker mentees, the songs will hopefully make the colossal open-access collection seem approachable, says Decembrist guitarist Chris Funk, who runs a recording studio on the grounds of the Boedeker building and mentored the song's production. Historical figures probably wouldn't be the first thing you'd hear written in modern music, Funk says, but his students' creations add a contemporary pop culture twist to the tales of prominent figures, like Solomon Brown, the Smithsonian's first African-American employee, and Mary Henry, the daughter of the institution's first secretary, Joseph Henry. Additionally, author-illustrator duo John Skiska and Steve Weinberg will debut How to Make a Collagerus, a how-to booklet inviting kids to transform the Smithsonian collections into zany new art forms. The approach is an echo of their 2019 children's book, Astronauts, which features a cast of goofy, colorful characters pieced together from images from the Rijksmuseum of the 2013 open access launch. In the booklet, Smithsonian founder James Smithson, backed by an entourage of astronauts, walks the reader through the construction of an example collagerus cobbled together from museum mainstays now in the public domain, including George Washington's arm, a stegosaurus tail, and Charlie Parker's saxophone as an elephantine nose. Stephen and I are perfectly built for that, Shizaka says. The thing I love to do is take something somebody else has and mess it up. The goal, he adds, is to encourage kids to do the same, and maybe even learn a thing or two along the way. Walking through a museum is one way you can see a work of art, Weinberg says. When kids make their own, that's when you start diving deeper into a subject. They're going to have this really rich knowledge of pieces of art. A bevy of research efforts are likely to flourish under the era of open access as well. In one partnership with Google, the Smithsonian has deployed machine learning algorithms to its data sets to flesh out its list of notable women who have shaped the history of science, an effort that's previously been aided by contributions from the public. Being able to see an item is very different than to make another use of it, Tanner says. You get innovation more frequently and earlier if the knowledge people are relying on is available openly. With more than 150 million additional items in its archives, museums, libraries, and research centers, the Smithsonian is featuring less than 2% of its total collections in this initial launch. Much of the rest may someday be headed for a similar fate. But Capsalis stresses the existence of an important subset that won't be candidates for the public domain in the foreseeable future, including location information on endangered species, exploitative images and artifacts from marginalized communities. If released, data and materials like these could imperil the livelihood, values, or even survival of a vulnerable population, she explains. The way people have captured some cultures in the past has not always been respectful, Capsella says. We don't feel we could ethically share these items as open access. Before that can even be discussed as a possibility, she adds, the communities affected must first be consulted and be made a crucial part of the conversation. But Capsella and other Smithsonian personnel also stress the importance of avoiding erasure. Many of these materials will remain available for viewing on site, at museums, or even online, but the Smithsonian will retain restrictions on their use. Representation can empower or disempower people, says Tanya Garagal, curator of painting and sculpture and Latino art and history at the National Portrait Gallery. It can honor someone or be mocking. We are not banning access. But some things need more context, and they need a different protocol for accessing them. Above all, the Open Access Initiative forges a redefined relationship between the Smithsonian and its audiences around the world, Capsella says. That means trust has to go both ways, but at the same time, the launch also represents a modern-day revamp of the institution's mission. The increase in diffusion of knowledge, now tailored to all the digital age has to offer. For the first time, visitors to the Smithsonian won't just be observers, but participants and collaborators in its legacy. The Smithsonian is our national collection, the people's collection, Funk says. There's something to that. To me, this launch is the Smithsonian saying, this is your collection to take and create with. That's really empowering. Catherine J. Wu is a Boston-based science journalist and Story Collider senior producer. Now here's a story that may make you want a cup of coffee. It's the history of the chicory coffee mix that New Orleans made its own. It started as a low-cost savings workaround, but stuck around for tradition's sake. And there's a picture of some beignets at the Café du Monde in New Orleans. I've been there a few times, and that's why I can pronounce beignets. They're a fluffy kind of square donut. By Annabelle Smith. Mardi Gras revelers in New Orleans may be needing all sorts of hangover cures this week, and they couldn't do better if they visited the legendary Café du Monde. and ordered beignets and coffee. The coffee, however, won't taste quite the same, and it's not because your stomach is reconfiguring itself in its post-bacchanalian recovery. Café du Monde, as part of what has become a New Orleans tradition, makes their coffee with chicory, the root of a blue-flowered perennial plant. Though the root has been cultivated since ancient Egypt, chicory has been roasted, ground, and mixed with coffee in France since the 19th century. The term chicory is an anglicized French word, the original being chicorée. The root traditionally was used on its own in tea or in medicinal remedies to treat jaundice, liver enlargement, gout, and rheumatism. Coffee, meanwhile, first came to European markets in the 17th century and quickly spread throughout the continent. Within decades, coffee houses arose in London, Amsterdam, Paris, and other centers of global trade. The coffee-chicory mixture probably began in Holland, but the drink wasn't widely recognized until 1801, when it was introduced to France by two men, M. Orban of Liège and M. Gerard of Homing, according to 19th-century writer Peter Simmons in his Coffee and Chicory, Their Culture, Chemical Composition, Preparation for Market, and Consummation. That was the long title. According to Simmons on the Culture and Commerce of Chicory, the industry around the plant erupted in the first half of the 19th century. In 1835, France exported 1.25 million pounds of chicory, and 25 years later, that figure had ballooned to 16 million pounds. Belgium and Denmark reported similar levels of consumption. In some parts of Germany, Simmons writes, the women are becoming regular chicory toppers, making of it an important part of their daily sustenance. American interest in chicory shared a culinary path to popularity, but first, coffee had to take root as the beverage of choice. After British taxes on tea imports and an infamous tea party rocked the colonies, the locals acquired a preference for coffee. The French, meanwhile, had their own claims in North America as well as the Caribbean, establishing coffee plantations in Haiti and post-slave rebellion Cuba. In founding the city of New Orleans at the mouth of the Mississippi in 1718, France solidified its trade access to the continent. Coffee crops would soon follow and become part of the city's culture, even as ownership of the port would switch from French to Spanish to French and finally to the United States over the course of the next 85 years. By 1840, the Port of New Orleans was the second largest importer of coffee in the United States. But during the Civil War, Louisianans looked to adding chicory root to their coffee when Union naval blockades cut off the Port of New Orleans. With shipments coming to a halt, desperate New Orleanians looking for their coffee fix began mixing things with coffee to stretch it out. Acorns or beets also did the trick, though chicory alone is devoid of the alkaloid that gives you a caffeine buzz, the grounds taste similar and can be sold at a lower rate. But some manufacturers roasted chicory with 2 pounds of lard for every hundredth weight, or CWT, of chicory to give chicory a better face. Parsnips were also added occasionally. Even burnt sugar was sold to coffee dealers and coffee house keepers under the name of blackjack. According to an 1874 article published in the Chemical News and Journal of Industrial Science, chicory coffee was cheap for this reason. It's been used in times of coffee shortage or economic crisis, like the Civil War and the Great Depression. It's also been used to stretch supplies in prisons. But if you ask a New Orleans native, it's all about their tradition. In addition to being delicious, the chicory in a café au lait, chicory coffee with hot milk, is an essential part of the city's history. The old-time coffee houses of New Orleans were situated within the original area of the city, the section bounded by the river, Canal Street, Esplanade Avenue, and Rampart Street. In the early days, most of the big business of the city was transacted in coffee houses. And that was from William Uecker's All About Coffee. When you look at the coffee aisle, you'll find chicory brands are limited to about three. Bert Benrud, vice president of Café du Monde, says, they really all originate here in New Orleans. Today, very little chicory is grown commercially in the United States for use in coffee. Café du Monde, for example, sources its roast from a company in Leroux, France. Fun fact, chicory is also the common name in the United States for curly endive. It's a fancy lettuce you might find at your local high-end grocery store or farmer's market. This kind of chicory also does not contain caffeine, and it certainly doesn't pair well with a beignet. Kay Annabelle Smith is a writer based in Santa Fe, New Mexico, who covers a wide variety of topics for Smithsonian. Her work also appears in Outside Online and Esquire.com. And you know, when I can, I like to share comments from the readers, and I'll share a few on this article. Café du Monde is also widely known as the coffee of choice for Vietnamese coffee, both in Vietnam and in the U.S. You'll find their orange tins at almost any Asian grocery store in America. And Viquas says, is this because of France's promotion of growing coffee in other countries in the 1800s? They occupied Vietnam for a long time. Adrian Sapolinsky says, this is so true. I can find it here at our Vietnamese store. And another person says, I'm interested in what culture first used chicory for medicinal purposes, which I'm guessing preceded its use as a beverage. It grows along the roadside in Colorado and is very pretty when the blue flowers are blooming. That's very interesting. And somebody else says, crap, crap, and more crap. This is how coffee has been made in India for centuries, and probably how Europeans found it. Even today, Indian filter coffee is incredible. And Anna Brown says, why do people have the desire to be insulting? The high ground is to educate people who may not know, and with sources. I want to know more about India's use of chicory now, but not everything in this article is crap, crap, and more crap. It's about New Orleans and their use, as well as which I can tell you is true. And on that note, we'll come to a close. I always like to hear what the readers have to say. You find a wide variety of opinions. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast, as most of our broadcasts, will be readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions for us, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. I enjoyed reading for you today.